AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday, the 27th. Good to be with you today. We are not here, once again, continuing with our brand new to you shows. We don't do best ofs. We record a whole bunch of interviews and we play them back. These have not been heard by you, it's just been an absolute delight. We've had some great interviews so far. Today, we have some sensational interviews as well, so I can't wait to get to those for you. But what I do want to remind you that, support your local the advertisers here on AM 950. They help bring you the programming here. Whether it's the great folks over at Rudy Luther Toyota, we love them over there. Stop on in. They've got great deals on great vehicles. I got two Toyotas. My family is a Toyota family. I love them. I love that Sienna. Also, Park Tavern, which you still have a few days to take advantage of that buy $100 gift card, get a $50 gift card free deal they've got going on. And of course, they got all the football games on. If you're going to want to go watch the games, no matter what your college team is, they've got the game on over at the Park Tavern. Thanks to them, Eat Local Minnesota as well. We're featuring all the restaurants this week. Great local restaurants, made them locally owned. You get a great meal that's pretty much a lot of money locally sourced as well. And, of course, the money stays local. EatLocalMinnesota.com. So make sure you help support AM 950. We love being here, and we love being part of your holiday celebration. Today, two exceptional interviews. The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism, and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota from 1880 to 1876. A phenomenal book about the problems that African Americans had post Civil War in Minnesota and how those problems. We get into a larger discussion with the author about how it's with William Green about how those problems from back then still are affecting us today. William Green joins us to talk about his book, The Children of Lincoln. Then Cliff Schechter, our fan favorite, he is in here to talk with some naughty words, by the way. We had to bleep him once or twice. Cliff will join us. We're going to talk about where he thinks the Democratic House is going to go in 2019. Some very good analysis from him as we are thinking about what exactly is going to unfold with the Democrats in the U.S. House in 2019. But first up, William Green, The Children of Lincoln, that interview when we come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Share a special experience with your loved ones this holiday season at Nightingale, an intimate eatery and cocktail lounge. Receive a $20 gift certificate for every $100 gift certificate purchased through the end of December. Enjoy their mulled wine and house-made eggnog, perfect for special occasions and holiday gatherings. A fun, cozy atmosphere and delicious, inventive dishes make for a memorable and warm get-together. Nightingale is located at 26th and Lindale in Minneapolis. More at nightingalempls.com.
It's the best time of the year. Toyota-thon is on. Rudy Luther Toyota has the 2019 models in stock, and to make room, the 2018s have to go. There are huge incentives from Toyota, and on top of that, Rudy Luther has additional huge discounts. And remember, you get my favorite perk from Rudy Luther, the Luther Advantage Card, which gets you 10 cents off per gallon at holiday station stores for 3 years with every vehicle purchase. Rudy Luther Toyota-thon is on. Stop in today, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Total Dog Company is the destination dog food and gear store on the west side of the Twin Cities with easy access off of 169. We have a growing group of loyal customers and increasing numbers of referrals from dog professionals and dog parents because we carry quality products, give sound advice, and are easy to do business with. Total Dog Company keeps up on the latest developments in dog nutrition and products. Find us in New Hope off of 169 at 9432 36th Avenue North and at TotalDogCompany.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. And I'm very excited about talking to my next guest. William Green is professor of history at Augsburg University, author of Degrees of Freedom, The Origins of Civil Rights in Minnesota from 1865 to 1912, and A Peculiar Imbalance, The Rise and Fall of Racial Equality in Minnesota from 1837 to 1869, both published by Minnesota Press. And as well, he's the vice president of the Minnesota Historical Society. His latest book is a very good one, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1873. Mr. Green, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate that.
One great thing about history writers that are really good at what they write, they find little elements of history that have been forgotten. And as I read your, you know, your background and the books you've written, you've done a, I think, a wonderful job of finding the underlying racial issues of the day that people kind of gloss over and they haven't really thought about when it comes to the 1800s in Minnesota. And I think that that's an interesting field to get into. What got you so focused on this level of history and this specific area of history?
Well, it really started a long time ago when I was thinking about college. My folks, I'm from New Orleans, and my parents were active in the civil rights movement, so I was very much aware of names like Hubert Humphrey and Don Frazier and Fritz Mondale, and I was a high school student and I knew what those names were. And yet I was surprised to learn that they were from Minnesota. And, you know, as far as I knew, Minnesota was a state that didn't have any African Americans. And so that sort of planted the seed. That wasn't true, but that was what I thought at that time. So that planted the seed for me to understand, what is it about Minnesota that would yield that kind of leadership on the national campaign for civil rights? And it kind of began a lifetime of study into the area. When I was in school, in a law school, I had to write a piece, and I found an article about a slave trial that occurred in St. Anthony, which is now Minneapolis, and that seemed really strange to me. And so in looking at that experience, I found that the story of civil rights history and of race relations in 19th century Minnesota was like peeling away layers of an onion. There were implications upon implications that had not been explored. And I think it's because the dynamic of race relations was so obscure, so minimal because of the relative absence of large numbers of African Americans that a lot of historians sort of glossed over it. And so I saw that as my purpose, trying to shed light on that dynamic.
You know, you bring that up, and of course, as going back to your position with the Historical Society, I think the Fort Snelling has done a magnificent job of pointing out that Dred Scott case came from Minnesota. I think as you talk about the layers of these racial issues that were here, I mean, granted, Minnesota was a relatively young state at the beginning of the Civil War, and we didn't really have any major metropolitan areas per se, as you would know on the East Coast. But at the same time, there's a history there that is lost, I think, because I think white America and the white education system sort of for a long time put forward this idea, well, and we solved the problem of slavery. Done.
Right.
And of course, that is nowhere near the beginnings of it. I mean, and I think it's part of the problem with the systemic racism that exists in the country today is the whitewashing of the racial history of a place like Minnesota, where, you know, we generally don't think of there being, you know, issues on this level, but there is a tremendous history of racial imbalance and racial injustice.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The challenge that I faced, though, was not just finding that history and understanding the history, but being able to really see the humanity of the people involved, people who did things which in the 21st century seem disagreeable and are disagreeable. You know, the paternalism that many of the white friends of black people had towards black people. But I felt like it was important to really kind of get at the, to respect what they did in terms of fighting a war that freed blacks, campaigning to extend civil rights coverage and protection to African Americans, to understand that commitment, and also understand how in the face of that commitment they could sort of forget that the work still needed to be done to deal with discrimination. I wanted to sort of give them some props while I think, you know, fairly pointing out some of the shortcomings of their view towards race.
And I think you do a very good job, because I think, like I said, a lot of this is lost unless you read a book like yours here.
Thank you so much.
The minority groups in Minnesota at the time of the Civil War. I mean, Native Americans were clearly the largest, what we would consider a minority group at that point. There was the uprising led to the tragedy over by Fort Snelling on Pike Island. You address some of these issues. You talk about some of these issues in the book as well. But as far as the African American population, kind of give us a little bit of a background. How large was it in the state of Minnesota at that point?
It was always a very difficult population to enumerate. There were African Americans who lived here before the territory was established. Some of those African Americans were laborers. Some of them owned even hotels or little cottages for travelers to stay. Some were servants. Of course, there were slaves at Fort Snelling as well. Sylvanus Lowry, who was a legislator and power boss from St. Cloud, had a plantation where he had a few slaves living there. So you had African Americans in all different kinds of categories living in the state, and they're oftentimes not even enumerated by census takers. So you basically learn about them. One was able to learn about them from memoirs and articles and newspapers and letters that were written. They were a pretty invisible population for all intents and purposes.
You mentioned the people that had slaves here. How did that, when, you know, was it one of those cases where, you know, to a point it was like, oh yeah, we're not really a slave state, but we're not going to make a big fuss about this? Or was this something that there was a shunning by the populace, the white populace here, that stopped the owning of slaves in Minnesota?
Well, up until the beginning of the Civil War at Fort Snelling, it was the custom of the War Department to permit officers to bring slaves to the places where they have been deployed. And so we find officers, oftentimes the commandants of the fort, but not exclusively them, officers of the fort who brought slaves from St. Louis. They would purchase slaves in St. Louis, which was a slave market, and they would just bring them up to serve as servants. The Indian agent, Lawrence Tolliver, who had come to Minnesota in the late 1820s, brought a number of slaves to be sold or rented to anybody who needed them. And that included missionaries as well as officers. So there was a sort of cottage industry, if you will, in slave trading in that regard. At the other hand, other extent, African Americans would jump on a steamboat, for example, especially after the 1840s, to escape the South, and they would just ride a boat, hidden oftentimes on certain boats whose captains were friendly to them, captains who would look the other way. Slaves would hide in the cargo section while the boat headed north to St. Paul. And there were free blacks who were here to receive those fugitive slaves and to help them escape. One famous African American, well, he wasn't famous, but one noted African American was a barber in St. Paul named William Taylor, and his wife Adeline, who received slaves at Lower Town and spirited them up to his shop. And at certain times where they felt it was safe to move them on, they would send them to another place where a safe house, in effect, later on in Minnesota. So African Americans were both free, and there were slaves who were here, and it seemed to be an arrangement that most white people found peace with, even though this was supposed to be free soil. That's the thing about Minnesota history. Even though the federal law and even though the social custom of Northerners who had come to Minnesota did not like slavery at all in principle, they learned how to make compromises to their presence. And I'll give one additional example. In the late 1850s, after Dred Scott was decided in 1857, the hotel in St. Anthony was a resort that slaveholders would come to vacation in order to escape the heat in the Deep South, and they'd bring their slaves with them.
The Civil War You know, as we have, I think, this idea that it resolved a lot, and it didn't. I mean, it ended slavery, and then the amendment ended slavery as a process here in the United States. But at the end of that, it was, I think there was a lot more feeling of promise for the African-American community after the Civil War than actually what materialized. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely right about that. Absolutely right about that. There was reason for optimism. At last, no longer would blacks be slaves, that they could be free, but they would be citizens. They would be a part of the body politic, and that was inspiring. I mean, before the Civil War, no one really could, or very few people could imagine a society in which slavery would no longer exist, and yet we had that very society. So African Americans, for understandable reasons, and a number of their white friends, for understandable reasons, felt like this was the beginning of a new day. But the problem was that patrons of black opportunity, felt that just granting the right to vote would be all that a person needed in order to have full opportunity in this new world. And what they did not understand was the very potent presence of discrimination, that whether a black person had a right to vote, it meant that an individual would be compelled to sell land to a black person if the black person had money to purchase it. A black person who had the ballot in his hand would not be guaranteed an opportunity to develop a skill, you know, to be an apprentice, to purchase a home anywhere that they wanted if they had the capital to do that. And so even though blacks had civil rights, the rights only went so far as political engagement. It didn't deal with equal opportunity. It didn't deal with certain quality of education, or employment or housing or even public accommodations, being able to be served at many of the restaurants and hotels in the cities. So it was limited.
Your book focuses on a few people here that they tried. And I mean, it goes back to what you were saying, what made you fascinated about Minnesota, is that there definitely seemed to be an element of fighting racial injustice in Minnesota.
Absolutely.
But there was also, and this was, you know, common everywhere, I think, in the United States, there was a post-Civil War pushback by, you know, angry whites, you know, and racists who basically were terrified of, okay, we've given you your freedom, but let's not get carried away sort of mentality. There were people in Minnesota that were fighting for equal rights, correct?
That's correct. There were. But it was a balancing act that policymakers and patrons had to negotiate. We had a huge infusion of unskilled laborers moving into the region after the Civil War, and the sensibility of the postbellum years that white people had towards blacks was that black people, by virtue of just being alive, was a threat to employment and opportunity for themselves. And so you began to see an anti-black sensibility deepen in the North. So even though, you know, the North did not support formally the kind of white supremacy that we see that occurred in the South under the banner of the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, you still saw segregation in the North, and you still saw a reluctance to invite African Americans to the community because of the fear that black people will take jobs away. And also the concern of blacks intermarrying with white people. That was a real concern for people in the North. So that's why I would call it a degree of freedom. Black people had freedom, but within limits.
In the South, and I've lived in the South a few times, and down there back at that point, if you were perceived as a white person, in many cases, not universally, but in many cases, if you were perceived as a white person who was trying to help the African-Americans get a leg up, that trying to equal the playing field, that you were yourself a target, and it was a target. I mean, you were, you know, considered an enemy, and in some cases, by some of the elements down there, even a more, you know, more worse enemy than the African-Americans getting their freedom for them. But in
That's absolutely correct, yeah.
In Minnesota, I mean, I never got the impression it was that bad. I've had a lot of people who have talked about the fact that there is definitely a racism in Minnesota. It's just much more subtle. Did this attempts to basically equal the playing field, when you talk about the people that were, you know, it was kind of a balancing act, you know, was the threat very tangible, like in the South, or was it more just a shunning?
No, I think it was possible. Well, it was possible for whites to express support for black rights during the 1870s and 80s. It was possible to do that. And if they were middle class, the people who were inclined to shun them were of a different class and therefore living in a different world. The working class white community lived in the parallel universe from the world of the white middle class. So the white middle class who would be sympathetic to the rights of black people would not necessarily face the shunning. What we saw, what I found at least, was a disinclination to, well, first of all, believe that that all that should be done had been done. In fact, there's a phrase that one of my subjects uses: we've done all that we've done our part, and now the rest is up to you. So there is a real belief that once the shackles of slavery had ended, had been removed, then it was left to blacks to kind of take it on their own, and that was very much in keeping with the sensibility of the times: rugged individualism, Horatio Algerism. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You don't need the artificial supports of government or people to kind of take care. If you can't stand up for yourself, then perhaps you deserve to fail. That was the sensibility that prevailed even among the friends of black people. And it wasn't just geared towards blacks. It was about how one looked at society. See, that's the thing about this book, and that's the thing about talking about race in post-war Minnesota in particular. The policies that hurt African Americans, or the attitudes that failed to really, go further in providing more opportunities for African Americans, was not anti-black per se, as much as it was anti, creating artificial support. I mean, people really believed in social Darwinism and the survival of the fittest. And it's one reason why farmers, for example, were denigrated, and laboring men and women were denigrated, and the poor as a whole were denigrated. And blacks were sort of caught in the midst of all of that. To make it even more complicated, even though black people weren't achieving, generally speaking, experiencing the full opportunity that they expected and deserved to have, there was a sense of blacks being, you know, sort of in a different category, that maybe they really can't get as far because of their race and their ethnicity. So you had a sort of perverse sense of paternalism began to set in, where we will take care of your problems, but you have to show gratitude to us. And that sensibility did not exist with mainstream America towards, or Minnesota towards the laboring class. And that, of course, exacerbates the tension and the anger and the resentment that working class whites have towards blacks.
I,
because
Well, and I was going to just say this is one of the reasons why I love talking history is we just went through 20 minutes and it just felt like a drop in the bucket. And if I may step in just really quick, because what you've just described set the stage for everything that's happened in Minneapolis just recently. And I want to get your take on this with a current issue, the Minneapolis 2040 plan, where they got rid of the zoning laws, which was going once again, as you talked about the system that was set up. Well, we're going to give you an opportunity without really giving them an opportunity. You can look at the housing setups and the way that they created this inability of African Americans to move ahead within society within property laws. It's taken a long time. Do you feel, first of all, that Minneapolis 2040 was a good step? And then do you feel as if it's going to actually have its intended consequences?
Well, I think from what I understand about the policy, I think it's a good attempt, but it doesn't always go far enough. I mean, I think that, if we're talking about creating opportunity across the board, it's multifaceted. It has to be viewed multifaceted. It's almost like you're talking about, housing and things of this nature. I was more involved with education and in closing the achievement gap. I think we as policymakers were rather myopic in thinking that it could only happen in the classroom when classrooms had kids for 8 hours. Now, the point that I'm making here, the connection I'm making, is that in improving, providing opportunity, policymakers really have to have the courage, and that's what it takes, to not only create a strategy that deals with housing, employment, education, all at the same time, providing stability and committing to it over a period of time, and being willing to defend the virtue of that type of commitment, because good deed fatigue begins to kick in, yeah. And that's where whatever progress one makes begins to slack off and begins to eventually erode. So it's we will always see, I hope, in this community efforts to try to deal with one piece of the problem. But if we're just looking at a problem myopically and piecemeal, I think we're forever going to fall short of the ultimate goal. It has to be much more comprehensive, and it has to be a commitment that policymakers will defend against the inevitable reaction to, we don't see immediate change, so we're going to shift the resources elsewhere. That's something that always happens, it seems like.
We are blessed to have you at the Minnesota Historical Society. Dear God.
Wow. That's really kind of you. Thank you.
We are blessed. My God. What? All right. Anytime you want to come back to my show, I swear. I mean, you've got the invite's open. You need to come back. You want to talk about an issue, I will give you the time. William Green, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. And as you just heard, the seeds of what happened back then are leading to the problems we have today. And I mean, they're big problems, but, to understand how to fix them, we have to understand how they began. And this book is a must read. Mr. Green, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Hi, this is Laura, and I want to tell you about my family's favorite thing. It's our wood stove. We bought it about 14 years ago from Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces. And see, the wood stove has actually paid for itself because we can keep the main area that we live in toasty warm with this great moist heat. But more important than saving money, it has actually improved our lives. Having a fire simplifies life. It provides comfort. It sort of takes the chill out of winter.
I'm Peter Solak. In 1977, I started Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, and I experienced the simple joy of warming myself by a fire. I also realized that the place and the way we embrace fire has evolved in a diversity of forms and styles. So at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, we have brought together the widest selection of our fireplace products and technical knowledge in the Twin Cities. Our mission is to use our knowledge to help you choose the design and function that is right for you and your home.
Visit Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces today and find the right fire for you.
Say goodbye to 2018, hello 2019 with the Park Tavern. The Park Tavern is open both New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Finish up your holidays with a relaxing and delicious breakfast with the Park Tavern family. It's a great time to get together with friends and family for a day of fun and relaxation. And of course, the Park Tavern will have all the football games on, so no matter what your team, they'll have you covered. On Louisiana Avenue, north of Highway 7 in St. Louis Park, ring in 2019 with the Park Tavern.
I'm Steve Conklin.
And I'm Jake DeRoff.
We're the hosts of the Mortgage Talk Show, Sundays at 12:30.
Every week we bring you insights on home financing, discussing rates, programs, local and national news.
Whether you're buying your first home or your 100th home, we have tips and inside information to save you money and feel like a mortgage master.
Check us out for more information and email us any questions at mortgagetalkshow.com.
Tune in to the Mortgage Talk Show every Sunday at 12:30 on AM 950.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Hunter Hawes. Thursday, rain with a high near 38. Friday, chance of snow, cloudy with the temperature falling to about 18. And Saturday, partly sunny with a high near 13.
Shop local with one of AM 950's advertisers this holiday season. There's everything from electronics, wellness shops, pet care, restaurants, and much more. It's a great way to not only support AM 950, but also local businesses and shops. Find a full list of advertisers at am950radio.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. It's the holidays, and of course, fan favorite Cliff Schechter is kind enough to join us. Founder, president of the PR firm Libertas LLC. He's advised campaigns, political organizations run by former President Bill Clinton, Vice President Al Gore, author of the 2008 bestseller The Real McCain, columnist for the Daily Beast, and of course, Unprecedented is the podcast. If you missed getting someone a great holiday gift, go get them, go to Patreon, get them a subscription to Unprecedented. Cliff is sensational on that. Cliff Schechter, kind enough to join us. Hey, Cliff.
Matt, that's such an intro. I don't know what to do with that.
Well, we're pretty much done for the interview. No.
Yeah, okay. If I'm such a fan favorite, you must have a serious lack of star power there.
Oh, no, you are. I would make an argument you are by far the favorite guest we have on this show. I can't think of anyone else that I get more people every time you're on. More people come up and say, you have to have Cliff on more often. I'm dead serious. You are very much liked in this town.
Well, thank you. I love Minneapolis, baby.
There you go. We'll make that your liner. We'll do that. We'll make a liner out of that for you. I want to mainly focus with you on what's coming down the line. Now, granted, you and I, as we are recording this interview, we're not doing this live, but at the same time, we don't know what's going to happen. I still think there's a 50-50 chance Trump will run screaming from the White House before the Democrats take power. But we're going to presume that
I think that's a legitimate possibility.
Yes, I think that we're going to presume Trump tries to stick it out with a ragtag bunch of administration people
and Mick Mulvaney doing every job in the White House. He'll be cleaning up at the end of the day in the Oval. In the morning he'll be providing security. He's his driver now. Mick's a busy man.
It looks like Lord Humongous is driving this crew. I mean, it just is. It is bizarre, and it is Lord Humongous. But I want to focus on where do you go? Because, okay, let's face it. For the Democrats, this is a never-ending buffet at this point. Republicans made up crap about Obama and Hillary Clinton and kept pushing and pushing. You don't have to. You can throw a dart any direction. You're going to hit a bullseye. Where do you think Pelosi – primarily Pelosi and the Democrats in the House, but also Chuck Schumer. Which direction do you think they're going to go in the next year?
Right. Well, let's start with the fact, as you were just saying, the wealth of opportunity.
Yeah.
If we're talking about just oversight and investigations, and again, I don't say this with the glee of a Republican. Is there some schadenfreude? Yes, because when people put kids in cages and a seven-year-old girl dies,
yes,
because of how, it makes me hate people. It really does. I try not to make political decisions based on that because I'm not a Republican. But at the same time, yeah, I want to see these people suffer somewhat. But the most important thing, and John Aravosis and I, who's my partner on Unprecedented, the podcast you're talking about, we always discuss this, which is our country comes first. You know, that we are under the mistaken belief that at least a lot of Republicans actually believe the rhetoric around the United States, at least, they were saying for 30, 40, 50 years, and why they opposed the Soviet Union. And, of course, what we've learned through this whole experience is even that was a lie. They're frankly, a lot of them are either traitors or they're willing to enable them to keep power, which is really sad. So I don't want to go pushing anywhere that doesn't make sense, but we have to perform this oversight. I mean, it is a key job of democracy. It's one that Republicans have failed to do. So let's start with the fact that the House Democrats, once they start looking to the Republicans, I think will be the fifth different entity. You've got FBI, you know, which at least those folks are that Trump doesn't control. You've got Mueller. You've got the Southern District of New York prosecutor.
Yes.
And I guess I'm throwing it into one entity. It's really three different ones. You've got three different state attorneys general of D.C., New York, and Maryland, maybe even more that I'm not even mentioning that I don't even know about. So and here's a key thing. There are 17 different investigations right now of Donald Trump. His foundation, his transition, his campaign, the Trump organization, the Trump White House. I mean, it never ends, right? So I would take a look out there and frankly see what is not being investigated. I mean, the rumors at least that have been out there is that Mueller is going to turn now to some of the stuff with Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's been pretty clear with the way the Trump administration was behaved towards Qatar, which the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Netanyahu's Israel have been united in trying to freeze out as they all behave. All these, frankly, they're either dictators or in Netanyahu's case, wannabe dictators. Behave in a way where they're trying to ally themselves against both Qatar and against Iran and pushing for a war in Iran. Well, what's happened there, especially around Kushner? I want to know. What is it? You know, is it true, as we've heard, that he sent information to MBS, to Bin Salman, so that he could purge? And let's purge is a nice way of putting it. Murder, torture, other Saudis? Did our intelligence help them to do that? Because that is sickening and an abuse. You know, did he know? Was he briefed? Were they briefed on what was going to happen to Khashoggi? And they let it happen? And then we know afterwards they tried to help explain to them how to get out of it. I want to know that too, because the truth is I think this could be as big as Russia. And we need to know what role that entity played in trying to help get Trump elected, trying to undermine Democrats. What, you know, was it illegal? Was it, you know, were they involved in any way, in whether it be social media or whether it be in actual sort of actions on the ground undermining Democrats and others? I want to know that. So that's a big area. Now, if Mueller takes it on in a huge way, maybe the Democrats don't need to do that. But the Trump Foundation, the Trump Organization, those are really seem to be taken care of by the attorneys general and other folks. I want to know about stuff about what Trump has done, abuses of power in the White House that haven't been looked at. Mm-hmm. What happened in Puerto Rico? Because it is a sickening stain on this country. It is a failure that almost makes Katrina look good in comparison. We need to know what the hell happened there, why that failure. The Republicans have refused to look into it. This should be something we should look into. We need to look into any foreign actions Trump is taking right now. There's a war going on in Somalia. We're bombing people. I'd like to know why. I'd like to know if there's a real theory behind it. If you go into this assuming that Trump lies about everything, then you can't trust what their reasoning is behind this. So I'd like to know. I frankly would like to investigate, and I don't know what the purview of this is, but I'd like to investigate people who have tried to undermine Mueller and find out what the situation is there.
Yes.
Including members of Congress on the Republican side. And I don't know if that's a possibility. I don't know how that works.
Yes.
I must admit to not being aware. I want to know Devin Nunes, and I don't care that Jason Chaffetz is gone. I want to know what he did. I want to know what these guys knew, what they were doing, how they were trying to hamper an administration, and if they were aiding and abetting a conspiracy after the fact. And treason, for that matter. I want to know because our government needs to work properly.
Quick question on that. Can the House investigate a senator? Because I would love to see what's up with Lindsey Graham as well, because he surely seemed to. You and I talked months ago, maybe a year and a half ago, about how easy it would have been for the Russians to really set these Republican dupes up by giving them money and then basically telling them, oh, by the way, before you speak ill will of Trump, oh, well, you should know we've funneled a ton of money through you, whether through the NRA or just through campaign donations, which you really didn't do your due diligence on. And, yep. You know, Graham is one of those guys that went and changed his narrative dramatically. Can the House investigate a senator?
You know, I wish I knew that. I could have looked into that before this. I didn't. I don't know. But some entity needs to do that, too. If that's involved in the whole Russia sort of meta-narrative. I wouldn't be shocked if that's something Mueller is looking into, or the Southern District of New York, if anything happened there. I certainly hope somebody is, because there's two people to me who it seems quite clear because of their change in tune. Well, I'd say three, actually, overall. Two of them are elected officials, which are Rand Paul and Lindsey Graham, who are just the biggest Trump critics in the world, and then suddenly they fell in love. I want to know what's going on there. Now, in Lindsey Graham's case, we had, I don't know if you know Marcy Wheeler, who goes by Empty Wheel, and she's been a longtime writer on national security issues, has worked at various publications and written stuff for the Washington Post. She, on our show, we had her on President a week ago, and she told us something that I was not aware of, because, again, following all the ins and outs of all this is so difficult. There's so much of it, which is, it wasn't just that they broke into the RNC server as well as the Democratic one, but they specifically hacked Lindsey Graham's emails. So take from that what you will. Look, you know, I'm not even saying it's anything negative, but there have been rumors about Lindsey Graham's sexuality for a long time. It's something he vehemently denies and refuses to talk about. And if we're going to have an honest conversation, not about that there's anything wrong with it, because to me, absolutely. In fact, it would be great. I wish there were more gay Republican senators. Quite frankly, maybe that would be better for all of us. But if it is true, and this is something that can be used as compromise against him because he doesn't want anybody to know, that's relevant. That makes this relevant. Just like a consensual affair is relevant if the Russians had information on Trump's affairs or other people's affairs, and they're using that because those people want those affairs kept silent. Mm-hmm. That is relevant. So I do want to know this. I want to know about Rand Paul, and I want to know about Lindsey Graham. The third person who I very much want to know about, who I see as just a convenient sort of idiot to have on their side out in public, is Alan Dershowitz, who I have also no doubt.
Yeah.
If someone is either paying or someone has compromised. Again, I'm not saying this because I'm sure Alan would love to come after people like me, or maybe I'm a big shot enough, whether with slander and libel. I have no proof of this fact. I'm giving an opinion. And when I see somebody do a complete 180 – in their persona and how they talk about things, I assume something's going on.
Well, it should be looked into. We have no idea what's happened, but, you know, you've opened the door. It's, you know, by all means, I think you're right there. I also want to go back to one thing you mentioned. You mentioned Puerto Rico, wildfire response.
Yep.
You know, the true...
Scott Pruitt.
The true...
The entire administration of Scott Pruitt, the entire, or cabinet, whatever you want to call it, of Tom Price, the entire... sort of tenure of Ryan Zinke, and I'm probably missing people because there's so many, Ben Carson, there's so much corruption
DeVos.
Here under Trump.
DeVos,
right, because,
yeah.
I mean, you know, Donald Trump, if there's anything he's done his entire life, is he's attracted like-minded people, as mobsters and dictators and others do. Others who have a lack of any morality also, who are completely amoral or actively enjoy hurting people, well, enjoy enriching themselves off other people, would look at someone like Donald Trump and see opportunity. Hence the collection of complete goofballs and evil that surrounds him. And there's a reason that your Seb Gorkas, you know, and those cabinet members I named and other, that these people choose to be around Donald Trump. Because he, like them, is a complete will to power type. So I want to look into all of them. I'd like to know anybody that was confirmed by the Senate, at the very least. I want to know what the hell they were doing with taxpayer money. I want to know what they were wasting it on. I want to. So these are all things worth looking into. I mean, Kushner is just is obviously a fat soft, a fat pitch over the plate. I mean, Kushner is there in the White House. He shouldn't have security clearance at this point. What the hell has he done? Who is he undermined, and how has he hurt the workings of our government? And from what we're hearing about Ivanka being involved with basically almost sort of selling off policy, it sounds like, when it comes to who gave donations to the transition, right, and the inaugural committee, I want to know what's up with that, too.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, what the House Democrats should be doing is what the Republicans have refused to do, which is the minute we have other aspects, the Trump Organization, the Trump Foundation, the Trump campaign covered by outside entities. But from the moment these guys came into government, when it comes to how they've run government, when it comes to the corruption, when it comes to the incompetence, when it comes to just the plain evil, I want to know what the hell they've been doing.
Well, and if I can step in here, one of the things, too, though, I think you and I are on the same boat. There is so much. This is an endless buffet. But when you're looking at the world of public opinion, the most damaging things to Trump, I think, are are the stuff like Puerto Rico, like U2, which hit all the American territories in the Pacific, and we haven't really heard anything about them. From what I've understood, I mean, most of those islands were completely wiped out, and I doubt Trump has done anything to help those. The wildfires in California, the death of a seven-year-old, the horrific conditions. I mean, we heard about four girls in that one Phoenix, Arizona facility, one of these kid prisons, that were raped by staff, sexually assaulted by staff.
Yep.
I think that if you look at these things, where it's the basic failures of government that led to unbelievable personal tragedy, that I think that, you know, kids that don't have a parent anymore because their parents were sent back to their country and immediately killed, and we still had the kid in a different prison facility. Those are the ones I think that are going to really resonate and really hurt the Republicans in the long run.
Yeah. I very much want to do that, because if there's any group of people that need to be hurt, it's them. But also, you know, for the good government purpose of this. too much of my podcast. I apologize. This stuff, if you will, is not supposed to happen in our government. It is not supposed to happen in our government. And the fact that we assume that with anything that any deal Trump makes, there's a corrupt premise, that anything he chooses to ignore is based on some sort of either purposeful, you know, ignorance or evil, or actual just complete incompetence. I mean, all these kinds of things we need to know. And the problem is there's so much of it, right? So there's so much of it that if you're Mueller or you're these attorneys general or others, they have very specific areas they can look into, where I feel like, you know, we don't need Congress looking into the Trump Foundation. We don't need Congress looking into some of those kinds of things, because they're being covered by people that have jurisdiction over them. And quite frankly, it's better to have as many different investigations as possible, because if this guy, you know, slinks out of federal charges, comes up with some sort of a deal to protect himself and his kids, and agrees to resign, well, guess what? That's not going to protect him from state charges. They're a completely different entity looking into it. And so that's the thing, I want all those investigations, but we need to know what this guy's been doing the nearly 2 years he's been in office. That I want to know. And the truth is, I'll say quickly, it's not just investigations. I want Congress to step forward with a bold and progressive agenda. And so Nancy Pelosi, if she's proven anything, she can outwit this guy with her, you know, basically half asleep. And she's a vote counter like none. We've probably one of the most effective speakers in the history of the Republic. She got through cap and trade legislation when she was the speaker for 4 years between 2006 and 2010 through a House that had a heck of a lot of coal state Democrats, right? And oil state Democrats. I mean, that's how talented she is. And so, I mean, let it show people for 2020, no matter who the Republican is, Trump, Pence, or some other idiot, what they could be getting from us if they would give us control of the government. And so let's go forward with a bold agenda economically, on when it comes to climate legislation, when it comes to gun legislation, when it comes to protecting women's rights and voting rights. Let's move forward on all of this.
We have about 3 minutes here. I do want to talk about Kavanaugh. How much should the Democrats go back and reopen that case?
Absolutely 100%. Okay. And because, you know, here's the thing. I forgot about that because there's so much scandal. What we know about Kavanaugh is we know that Deutsche Bank, their offices were raided most recently because of the fact that they've been a money laundering, you know, outfit for God knows how long. They were one of the few banks willing to deal with Trump. And his contact there was one Supreme Court Justice Kennedy's son. You may have forgotten that. A lot of people have forgotten that. I want to know what the deal was there. Why did Kennedy step down at the perfect time? So Kavanaugh, is there something there? Maybe there's nothing there. But I don't believe in that many coincidences. And then I want to know about Kavanaugh itself. What were these guys doing behind the scenes to lie? Some of this stuff came out. We know some of the crap they were planting in newspapers. We know some of the stuff they were lying about. We know some of the things they were doing. I want to know more. I want to know more about his past, and I want to know more about the operation to try to undermine anybody who came out against him.
You know, it is interesting because that ruling that just happened with Planned Parenthood, where he actually stood up for Planned Parenthood and saying you can't just kind of, you know, punish them, you have to fund them. It seems to me that Kavanaugh understands the playing field, and that if he comes on out with a lot of real nasty rulings, or I don't know, I mean, there's a lot of people that point out that Trump's not really a Republican. He could have one of these guys that does, you know, he puts forward this bravado, but the reality is he's not nearly as anti-abortion or anti-Planned Parenthood as some of these other people. But needless to say, I think he's playing the political game because he knows he's in trouble.
He's always been a political operative. That's why he never should have been on the Supreme Court. I mean, he was an operative for Ken Starr you know, and for the Republicans and getting their former Supreme Court justices on under George W. Bush. So as far as I'm concerned, absolutely, he's an operative. He's smart enough to know that right now the Democrats control the House, and I think he's trying to make nice. I don't trust for one second. I think he figures, after the controversy of how he got in and everything, come up with a bunch of moderate rulings, join the left and a bunch of things that aren't as important because this wasn't really an abortion decision in the end, and then we'll see what happens. Roberts is really the wild card.
Yeah.
You know, I want to look into Kevin Roberts as somebody who actually, I think, cares about the legacy of the court, cares about his legacy. He knows his name will forever be associated with this court. He upheld Obamacare before. I could see him almost undoing some of the rulings that have proven to be so dangerous and terrible for the Republic. I'm interested to see what he does if further campaign finance decisions come up or voting rights, because he's going to be remembered for all this. So it'll be interesting. But Kavanaugh, look into everything. Don't trust the guy.
One final quick question here. Will we have an impeachment vote in the House?
I think yes.
Yes.
I think the preponderance of information will be such that it comes out that it will be a necessity. But even if they think they can crush the guy in 2020, even if they think, you know, if he doesn't resign and walk away, I don't know how you won't with what I think is going to come out from Mueller, from the Southern District of New York, from the attorneys general and others. I think it's just – it's going to be so much. I mean, this guy's entire life has been corruption. So
yeah, you're right. And I just say, like, when I heard Susan Collins the other day make a comment about, oh, I'm waiting for the final word to get in. So what are you waiting for at this point? You clearly, if you had this much information against Obama, you would have impeached him 500 times over already. It's
I think a lot of House Democrats who wanted even more purple districts. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but
go ahead.
I just say quickly, you know, would rather not deal with this, but I just feel like they're going to have to. You know, and I'm not even saying I want them to. I mean, there's a big argument out there. What would be better, impeaching the guy or indicting him while he's in office and getting rid of that stupid rule? Because it makes no sense to say a guy who achieved a position illegally should be able to avoid prosecution by staying in that position. So let's get rid of that stupid. That was an advisory ruling. It's never been proven constitutional. So I say indict him. Or the third thing, obviously, is if he walks away, you get one of those things. But if he stays there, I kind of feel like I don't know what else you do. You have to impeach, or there's no point in ever having the process there.
Unprecedented podcast. It's like this, only with more swear words.
I only said one of them. It looks like they need a gold star for that or something.
You're brilliant. And by the way, get the podcast. It's go to Patreon, pay for the podcast. It's a fantastic podcast. You get to listen to Cliff Schechter here on AM 950. We sure do enjoy him here. Cliff, merry bleeping holidays, man.
You too. You're awesome. Don't tell me awesome. You're a guy I need to hang out with more. So I'm figuring out a way to get my stupid butt. See, I didn't curse there. To Minneapolis, or we got to get you here.
I would love to see you in Cincinnati. All my best, my friend, and thank you very much.
Happy holidays, buddy.
Happy holidays. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
If I don't feel your arms wrapped around me, then to every rest stop in the country, without you all this dream would feel so empty. Turn to you after we play the first song to ask you.
You know how it is with vacuum cleaners. You buy them, you break them, then you throw them away, right? Well, not necessarily. Often, fixing your vacuum can be cheaper than replacing it. Ever heard of A1 Vacuum in Roseville? They offer free estimates. So if you wish your vacuum worked like new again, drop by. A1 Vacuum is ready to help clean up your vacuum cleaner act. Find us at a-1vacuum.com or call 651-222-6316.
Branding Electrolysis on Grand Avenue in St. Paul has been a leader in permanent hair removal for people of all skin types and backgrounds for over 30 years, celebrating diversity and priding themselves on finding the right treatment plan for each client's individual needs, regardless of race or gender. Services include electrolysis, body waxing, facials, microneedling, and permanent makeup. Book your 60-minute complimentary consultation, including a 15-minute treatment today, for beautiful, lasting results. Visit BrendingElectrolysis.com.
Stop and listen for a second. Do you hear that? It's peace, quiet, and tranquility. After a busy holiday season, that's what you'll experience at Big Bear Lodge just off the Gunflint Trail. There's always an abundance of snow and winter activities like ice fishing, snowshoeing, snowmobiling, and world-class cross-country skiing. Then cozy up in one of Big Bear Lodge's guest rooms or authentic woodsy cabins. Come find your smile at Big Bear Lodge. More at BigBearLodgeMN.com.
Thank you very much to Cliff Schechter. Once again, Unprecedented is the podcast he does. It's over at Patreon. You can go subscribe. It's what the cool kids are doing, and you get to hear him unedited, you know, with some naughty language as well on the podcast. So make sure you go get Unprecedented with Cliff Schechter over at Patreon. You can listen to a little bit of it as well on iTunes. And also William Green, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism, The Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. An exceptional book. If you love history, especially you love history and how it impacts us today, that is a must-have book. William Green, exceptional job. We are back, a live show on Friday the 28th, and then we have more brand-new-to-you shows starting up on the New Year's Eve with Jeff Stein. Jeff Stein joins us on New Year's Eve. Have a great one. We're back tomorrow. Until then, see ya.